Hello, everybody. My name is Benny Rachmanov, CEO of iShook. As we always like to do is venture out to other CEOs and entrepreneurs and what they've been doing in the past decade so far. With us veterans, we're a decade almost out there. So I have over here our good friend, Tony Magavero, and we're here to understand what does he do? Where is he from? What is his presence in LinkedIn? I just found this guy off the bat. Asked him, let's do a podcast. Boom, we're here. So, Mr. Magavero, how are you? How's everything? Talk awesome. To us. What do you guys do? What is your vision? And how are we here to change the world almost?
Thanks for having me. Definitely. Yeah. It's been quite the journey to where we are today as a company. What we believe in as a company and where we see kind of the next 10 years is that, fundamentally smart contracts and what blockchain, the power that blockchain provides, will bring more transparency and efficiency into kind of the creator economy and how studios and creators get paid on the content that they're creating. So, we've been working with smart contracts since like 2017, primarily in Ethereum, but it branched out into other chains as well. And we actually started as a virtual reality streaming company. And, of course, like as the VR streaming space, took off in 2014, 2015, 16, 17, there was a lot of excitement, a lot of investment, and content creation but that started to kind of hit some headwinds, and a bunch of companies actually started turning off their VR initiatives, like Google and Samsung, and all the major studios stopped experimenting with it. And so, really only a couple companies carried the torch: Sony with the PSVR and Meta with the Quest. And so we just had to look at ways to continue to innovate in the content and the streaming space, because you can't just go compete with Netflix and, buy content as your differentiator. They spend $15 billion a year producing new content. So, and I think we've kind of seen the peak of that, but it's still impossible for startups to compete with. So, we have to look at things that are, frontier technologies, things that we're personally passionate about, and where does that intersection kind of sit? So, we've been doing kind of the smart contract stuff since 2017, but, I've been in Bitcoin since 2012 and been a longtime believer in the technology and have continued to invest and build in the space. So, that's kind of where we are as a company for RAD. And, we're trying to kind of be thought leaders and push and innovate and let people know kind of all these new technologies and what we're doing. But we know that it takes time. So doing things like this, I'm very thankful for, because it helps educate, and that's half the battle, right?
Yeah, that's the educate. Well, we want to make in my experience, education in a product has to be simplified, right? Either through tutorials, podcasts, so on and so forth. But for sure, listen, one of my biggest questions I'm going to ask just from your opening is, and I have to ask this, you said everybody stopped the VR. So then why did Apple start a VR if everybody is stopping VR? And if you're saying you're stopping VR, from what I understood, correct me if I'm wrong, then why are you stopping if you see Apple is doing it? Obviously there's a future to VR, right? Mm-hmm. And they're obviously had their, I know their applications for VR for medical, for engineering, where you can be on one side and actually see the site somewhere else. Right now, tomorrow, I have a virtual walkthrough. Obviously, not with a VR, but it'll be cool if it was with a VR. But a virtual walkthrough for a prefab of housing in a manufacturing facility. So, seriously, what's going on? Why you're not in the VR? If Apple is doing it, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, I think it just kind of followed the hype cycle, right? Where and this is kind of like the second wave of VR. We had a first wave of VR kind of like 20 years ago, and you had Nintendo playing around with some stuff, and it was making everybody sick. And then you had this second wave of VR, which was kind of like the Oculus Kickstarter, and then a bunch of additional follow-on investment, and this big run up for kind of like 2013 to 2017, 2018, and then everything just fell off a cliff. And then you have like this kind of reset and rebuilding starting to happen. That's a little bit kind of slower growth. And so then you see companies like Apple, they can afford to be late. You know, they can let everybody else make all the mistakes and then say, okay, this is what we're doing. And so I think their approach is really interesting in that the device will be pretty expensive, out of the reach for most people. You know, they're looking at it as a replacement for your computer in some ways. So whereas like the other devices were essentially attachments to a computer, and or stick your phone into a headset, and like that, it's kind of like a pairing type situation. And I think Apple's looking at it as like a, you know, an entirely new computing platform in its own right, which is why it's, you know, $3,500, or that's the price that's getting kind of thrown around, right? But, you know, the losses that Meta has been taking for investment and trying to own this kind of device and platform, it's just been enormous losses for them, and very difficult because they're not traditionally a hardware company, whereas a company like Sony and Apple are more traditionally hardware companies. And so, you know, they understand manufacturing and user experience around a piece of hardware. And so I think it's just required that, you know, we've had to be patient. We didn't abandon VR at all. We said, you know, we said that we would listen to kind of what was happening in the market, and that like if the device manufacturers were pulling back and the content studios and content partners that we had were pulling back, we had to make some adjustments to make sure that we didn't die in that moment in 2018, 2019. We still have VR apps. We still have a PlayStation VR app. Our PSVR 2 app is about to relaunch. We're on the Quest, but it's like they're kind of in a weird place because it's in this labs setup. But we've also requested the Vision Pro headset as well, and, you know, or at least the developer SDKs. So we're in that process now as well. So, you know, I still think that kind of human computer interaction around VR and, you know, essentially what it looks like Apple's positioning for is more of kind of a blended, you know, XR, AR kind of headset where you can switch between modes. You can be in VR, you can be in AR. And so that I feel like will be a good approach. It's just going to be very expensive, and you know, the number of devices won't be very big. So we as a company have to think, okay, if we're putting developer cycles towards devices and we're going to target 10 million VR devices, or we're going to target hundreds of millions of smart TVs and game consoles and, you know, billions of mobile devices with the same cycles, like which one are we going after? So, you know, we've used VR as a differentiator, that we have a presence there, that we can support immersive content, and that makes us different than most other streaming platforms in its own right, in a similar way that using smart contracts for licensing of content and commerce differentiates us. So we have those couple, you know, forms of kind of technical differentiation, and but we still have to think about what the footprint is and what the reach is of those devices and kind of where they are in their release cycles. And you know, it's probably going to be another 5 to 10 years for VR to get to that point where it's a little bit, you know, wider adoption in terms of the mass market. And, you know, it's still a little bit early.
No, I got that point, but my obviously concern, is, well, first of all, you said many things, right? So one thing that I understood is that there's two types of VR business models. One is a standalone VR, and the other one will be potentially, or which is right now existing, are accessory use ERs, VRs. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. The product that you have is an accessory to other platforms that exist, right? So like Sony or like mm-hmm. PlayStation and so on and so forth, which I get that. Mm-hmm. That's I think that's more reasonable than a standalone. What are you getting at a standalone? But then my question will be, in your experience, why is there not an investment push, not on VR per se, but on, let's say, potential glasses that can recognize holographic images. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would be, I think, the more cooler type of VR, as opposed mm-hmm. to sticking all the imaging in my face, where potentially I get sick from that, right? Because even Sony PlayStation, they give you this, you know, this notice, like, don't spend more than 2 to 3 hours at a time, you know, playing, and that's their 4K. That's on their 4K, you know, PS5 and PS4. Actually, they both put out those notices. So I can only imagine how much more so, like, a screen right in front of your face is. I mean, I would have thought that they would have applied more of the 3D. And I know there's this holographic thing going on in China, and it's very cheap to develop. What the heck is going on? I just don't get where we at. I mean, I don't see Star Trek with VR. I see Star Trek with the cell phone. You know, where's the Star Trek growth? You know, like, like, that's my main thing. We're going to more Mad Max situation here. Yeah, VR, no use.
Yeah, the number of layers that are required to support really high performance, you know, augmented reality and pass through displays and depth sensing and anchoring of content in a space. It's an enormous amount of computing power that's required, and a bunch of different layers that had to be established before that was even possible. And if you looked at what, you know, Apple and Google did on their operating systems, this is like, I guess it's probably 2018 or 2019, somewhere around there, but they started releasing AR natively into their operating systems and pairing that up with the depth sensors and the hardware. And, you know, you can see things like unlock with your face. That's not just like taking a picture of your face, it's incorporating depth sensor data. And so the sensors had to be available, the operating system core components had to be available, and then something that's powerful enough to run that is required as well. And so, you know, you can do pass-through augmented reality on a phone because they're fairly powerful, but they're also, you know, for as small as they are, they're still pretty hefty devices. So if you hold up an iPhone and you have pass-through on and you can look at like a little hologram on your table, there's enough power in there to handle that. If you put that on a pair of glasses, like a pair of lightweight, you know, Ray-Bans or whatever, like lightweight glasses, the computing power has to be there in order to support all of that sensor data and, you know, rendering and all of that. So putting that onto a pair of glasses is very difficult because, you know, this phone is a lot heavier
even
than
if they
a pair of glasses.
Even if they would do the iPhone or the glasses like the original had the iWatch was, because the iWatch was connected to your phone.
Mm-hmm.
And really
the
phone would just transmit the video. So it's just an open screen. So you tell me even at that level it's that difficult?
Yeah. I mean the challenge there becomes is that, you know, you have to either transmit that information wirelessly, which in when you're talking about watch data, it's, you know, small amounts of data because it's mostly like text data. When you're talking about like
visual
volumetric
data.
Video or something that's very rich data, that's an enormous amount of information. And so when you have a pair of glasses on, and you even saw this with PC connected virtual reality, if you connected, you know, the original Oculus to a PC, a high-powered PC with a high-powered GPU, you know, you still had enough delay when you were head tracking that it would make people sick. And that was coming from like a giant PC.
Wow.
And so I think it's like 13 milliseconds. If anything above 13 milliseconds in terms of delay, your brain will interpret that as something's not right and you'll start to get sick. And that's difficult to achieve even with, you know, a PC connected VR headset, let alone like a pair of glasses tethered to a phone.
Wow.
So there's that's why, you know, Magic Leap had essentially a wired connected like mini computer companion to their headset, and the glasses themselves were fairly substantial, much more substantial than like a, you know, a pair of sunglasses. So that's the real struggle. Is how do you get it small enough and light enough and fast enough and minimize the computing to a point where it just becomes like, you know, a second nature kind of wearable that you are used to wearing today.
Definitely.
Yeah,
we're still a way behind. I was going to ask you, how do we apply esports to it, right? Like, that would be cool where you can have esports or e-tournaments on it by playing, let's say, Fortnite or any of the other games with this kind of virtual kind of setting, you know. But obviously, it's not possible at this level right now. We're not there yet. CPU level. But again, if you're going to have such a high level CPU level, why would I risk my eyes in front of such a CPU level? Why would I do it? I would take more of the accessory use than putting a PC in front of my eye. That thing could either explode or who knows what. These are my eyes, man. This is like makes me see. I mean, like, what's the thought process in that with Apple? I mean, what do you think? I mean, obviously you're in a better, you know, better business position and business model and actual visual, you know, your product model is even better than compared to that.
Yeah. Well, I've had a laptop that had a battery bulge out of the back of it and, you know, get to the point of almost exploding. So it may be an exceptional risk, but it is, you know, there is some concern about putting things that close to your face. I mean, I think humans also, it's just hard to change human behavior. And we've gone, you know, millennia without putting things on our face. And then all of a sudden, we're like putting computers on our face and expecting that to be natural in some kind of a way. And people just get uncomfortable after 15 minutes with them not being able to see and feel and hear their surroundings. It just makes for an uncomfortable situation. So, you know, I think as much as it is like the discomfort of putting technology on your face, it's also just like human nature to be nervous about being disconnected from your real world for that period of time, not being able to see what's. And so, you know, Apple, I think, has done, at least in their presentation, did a decent job of showing that, you know, they aren't enclosing you fully in, and you can, you know, you can make it that way, but it's also like the edges and the pass through are certainly, there's more consideration given to those things than there were to like full immersive VR headsets and devices. So the hardest thing really is going to be human behavior. And the most comfort that we have is just wearing a normal pair of glasses on our face, whether, you know, it's sunglasses.
Well, the pair of glasses helps me see. I mean, that's the fact.
Yeah.
I'm wearing glasses now. Without it, I won't be able to see clearer. You know, I mean, like, because I have three screens in front of me here, including our discussion here. I have to be able to read and see and, you know, respond to what I'm looking at. I mean, I do see a future. Don't get me wrong. For sure, in training, And in testing and endurance wise, mental, physical endurance, maybe military applications or pre-military or pre-training, for sure, you know, the military will have use for it in the future. Of course, they're going to have attachments to their powerful computers that they have available to them. But yeah, definitely. I mean, I see that available. If it's going to be for commerce, that's yet to be seen based on what you're telling me. How do you get the, so let's get to the blockchain and the smart contracts. So how do you create a synergy between your VR product and the smart contracts of Ethereum? Because I can't even think off the bat what kind of connection you would have there.
Yeah. No, I mean, they're just two different things coexisting. I mean, VR and 360 degree video or 180 degree video is just a content type. Traditional video, you know, 1080p or, you know, HD or 4K, that video is just a content type, right? So if we have a content management system and somebody can upload a video, whether it's a traditional video or an immersive video, it runs on the same streaming infrastructure, it runs through the same transcoding, it can go to the same devices, et cetera. All that is just a piece of content getting to an end user. And, you know, the way that people have gotten paid in digital content has evolved into this, you know, like a Spotify will rent you every month a library of music, and Netflix every month will rent you a library of TV shows and movies. And from a creator's perspective, that means that, you know, if you, you know, I'll kind of simplify it a little bit. If you as a studio, make a movie and you put it on iTunes, right?
Right.
And a customer, a consumer comes and buys that movie for $20 and they watch that movie. You know, they essentially, that $20 goes into Apple's back end. They take their 30% on it. And then, right, you know, the rest of that money goes to the studio, Disney or whoever it is. And then the studio does their accounting on that. And then anybody who has royalties on the back end, then the studio will cut their check and send that out. And it's kind of the same thing with Spotify, and that, like, somebody pays $15 a month, Spotify takes their cut, they pay that the rest to the label aggregators, then the label aggregators take their cut, then they pay the labels take their cut, and then they pay the artists, right? That process can take 90 to 120 days or a year, you know, like, it just kind of depends. And then usually what ends up happening is that the artist or actor or writer or whoever is supposed to get paid, they don't have the time or the energy to go audit that trail. They can't go back and ask each part of the chain, did I get paid what I was supposed to get paid? They just take the check and they say, well, that was smaller than I expected, or that was bigger than I expected, and I'm going to go about my day. And so what smart contracts do is just enable the purchase side to come in and say, here's $20 for this movie. Inside the smart contract, it has all the specifications of who should get paid, and they get paid immediately. So within 20 seconds instead of, 6 months. And that's the paradigm shift. You don't so need.
How many creators do you have? How many creators on your platform do you have so far?
Well, since we started out as a traditional platform, I mean, we have hundreds of channels, and that's like goes into publications like Complex Magazine to individual creators. And, so essentially what we're doing now is onboarding new creators in this kind of, you know, smart contract backend that allows them to publish content and specify the revenue shares that they should be getting paid, or everybody who worked on something should be getting paid. And then the purchasing mechanism for actually buying that content and having people get paid instantly with multiple revenue splits, that's in beta testing right now. So that we'll release that going into the end of the year with some of our existing content partners, as well as a bunch of new ones that we're onboarding right now. So
that's very cool.
Yeah, but it's kind of timely in that when you look at, like, you know, the what's going on with the writer strike and, you know, the actors, it's like there's frustration there that they don't have transparency, that they're getting left out in the cold when it comes to their content landing on a streaming service and then just not getting paid from it at all. You know, they want more transparency, they want more immediacy, and they deserve it, right? Like, so in this moment, you know, a bunch of us on our team have been creators, and either in the music space or in the video space. And so we've seen firsthand how long it takes to get paid royalties. I have music on Spotify, and I get an email like every once in a while that says I got paid. I literally just ignore it because I don't know. it's so small, and I'm not going to go chase it down, right? So
are you going to provide higher royalties, or are you going to just are you just aggregating the process? Are you showing just the process of payment, or are you actually going to provide higher royalties? What is your business model? I mean, that's my main question.
Well, yeah. So we as a platform obviously have operational costs. So, you know, we have to encode video and build applications and stream that globally across devices. And so, you know, we have an infrastructure and a team that we have to support to build all of this. But the payment mechanism itself is direct. So, you know, if we take our fees, platform fees, which can vary kind of depending on the deal that we do, but, you know, call it 30% because that's easy enough to keep in mind. But the rest of that goes to the creators. Instead of it being like, you know, with Spotify, you know, 30% goes to Apple, and then the label aggregators take their 5%, and then the labels take their percent, and then
right, so it goes down. Yeah.
Yeah, what the artists are left with is, you know, 10% or whatever. So but
ultimately, if your platform is going through Apple, you're already minusing 30%, and you're getting that 70%. That 70% is your 100, and from there you're giving them the 70.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're doing it direct, and they can get paid directly, primarily on the web. And so, you know, we
so do we're not talking thing. About iOS. So you're not talking about iOS then. I just want to clarify. Well,
yeah, yeah. So, you know, the interesting trick about the Web3 space, at least currently, is that there is no real integration by any of the device manufacturers yet. And so we have to do similar things that you know, Amazon and Spotify have figured out, in that you can't, there are certain things that you just can't get on the device itself. You have to go to their website to purchase it, put it in your library. And then when you go to your library on the device, it's in there. And that, you know, no way Amazon's paying Apple 30%. Like, no, they're just never going to do it. And Spotify has started to, you know, and they've been doing this for a long time, but essentially saying, no way we're paying that 30%. And now Apple has kind of antitrust stuff going on in Europe, and it's making its way to the US as well. So I think over time what we'll see is that the device manufacturers won't be able to hold people hostage to that 30%. And that's the bet that we're making. So we as the platform have to pay for our operation fee.
What's the risk value? What's the risk value on that bet? I'm sorry for cutting you off. What's the risk value on that bet?
I don't know. We're either going to be right or wrong.
That's a big right or wrong. That's a huge right or wrong. That's a nail biter right there. I mean, like 30%, yeah. Keep or not keep, or they're going to win it or not win it. That's crazy.
Well, and I think what we're doing is just kind of following the lead of the Spotify's and the Amazon's, right?
Yeah, like, there's no guarantee they're going to win. I mean, Amazon end up creating their own platform for ebooks. I mean, we're in the ebook space and also similar space that you're in, but not at all exact to by far means. I mean, but in reality is like, we're not betting on the 30%. We're saying, okay, there's 30%. We're keeping the 30%. And you guys eat all of it for all we care. You know, like we have other ways of making financial gains. But I think it's like I'm caught for words, but I'm trying to say it in the right way. That is a noble risk taking. Yeah. And I hope you're right. I mean, because if you're right, then we're all good, right? Then we're all making good money. I mean, I hope you're right on. I mean, they've been holding it in their ground for 10, 15 years almost. So
Yeah. No, I mean, it's been a fine.
And the joke, by the way, I got to tell you this joke. The joke is,
when
you want to develop on Kindle, Amazon, right? They take 30%. Mm-hmm. Amazon takes 30% from people like us, but they want to pay Apple the 30%. So there's the irony.
Yeah. No, I think like, philosophically, that's what's so exciting about the Web3 space, is that it removes middlemen. And, you know, I'd almost rather have stay on the track that the internet was founded on the principles of a decentralized kind of nature and ownership and privacy and commerce. And then over time, a handful of companies have centralized that power and that value. And we're going through kind of this awakening moment in what started off as Bitcoin and has been, you know, 12, 13 years now that we've been getting into decentralized finance and decentralized content and NFTs, like all of these things like seem like memes.
I'm gonna cut you off here again. Explain Web3. We said Web3 at least 10 times, all right?
Yeah.
The audience is not gonna get what Web3 is. What is Web3? Please define for us what Web3 is, because I myself am at a loss. I've been always told, people are always telling my telemarketing group, dude, are you going to be Web3? I'm like, dude, I don't know. You want me to disrupt the whole industry? I mean, I'm trying to make money in the industry. I'm not trying to be in a space that doesn't make money yet. Please talk to me. Tell me what this Web3 is. You got to explain it, because we're not going to understand anything else you're going to say thereafter. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. I apologize for this. Yeah, I mean, essentially, like, we've had eras in the internet, and Web 1 was like the most basic kind of, everybody has a website. It's, very basic, simple kind of HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. And then Web 2, you start to see the explosion of developer APIs and the programmable web, and you know, smartphones and apps launching on smartphones that need kind of API driven websites. So you get this marriage of devices and the dawn of kind of like, you know, streaming and OTT platforms that are, you know, streaming digital content over the internet. And then now we start to get to this place where there's a missing layer of the internet, which was, you know, what does ownership look like on the internet? What does commerce look like on the internet? And not like I'm entering my credit card details into a website and sending that off and Visa's processing something. What is the native layer of ownership and payment that sits in the internet that it's such that I don't even need Visa? And so you start to see this new currency evolve. And then you start to see this idea that, you know, there should be, you know, a way to program this money. How do you create a wallet that sits inside of your browser that you own, that a bank doesn't own? You know, if you go to the bank and you set up a checking account, they own all of your information. They own the ledger. Any transactions that you do have to go through the bank, and they essentially own that information. They custody it. It can get hacked and people can steal your money, whatever. Silicon Valley Bank can go down and you can lose all your money, whatever. With this idea of you custodying your identity and your money and your content or ownership, now that we're seeing kind of, you know, the evolution of decentralized content, now you have your own wallet, your own ledger, your own money. And when you go to a website, and this is what you're starting to see now, instead of logging in with your username and password, and Facebook stores all of your information and they have all a huge profile about you and they can abuse that data however they want, sell it to advertisers, you know, have it influence elections, whatever it is, like that data, they own it. Whereas with Web3, you are keeping that information in your wallet and your identity is local to you. And when you connect to a website, you're giving them a temporary pass to read your information, but it's, you can disconnect it at any time. And so, you know, from an identity perspective, you have more control over your identity. When you pay for something using this kind of identity and wallet, you send that payment directly to the other person. You don't send that through the website where they can abuse that transaction in various different ways, and then they send that money to the person. You are sending that transaction peer to peer. And so the person on the other end can trust that that transaction completed, because the blockchain and the work that's being done to verify those transactions will be the ultimate ledger for that information.
So basically, the way I'm understanding Web3 is basically another layer for internet in order to create an SDK kind of transaction with crypto.
Yeah, it's essentially, you know, giving the people...
Essentially trying to bypass the current structure of how we pay via the internet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's essentially Web3.
It's and you know, that goes from, you know, monetary transactions to what we're now seeing is the evolution of content, is that if I buy a movie with my wallet in my browser and my identity, if I buy that movie, I own that movie. It's not that I bought the movie on Amazon Prime Video and then it sits in their account only and I can't go view it anywhere else except on Amazon. And if I buy something, now I own it. And with NFTs and what we're seeing now, even though it's very kind of hype driven and, you know, lots of memes in the moment, it gets back to originally when we used to go to the store and buy a DVD or, you know, buy a CD. If I wanted to give that DVD to my neighbor, I could do it. And you know, here you go. If I wanted to resell it, I could resell it for $5, right? Maybe I had a collector's edition of Gladiator. And
yeah, but are you really selling the actual video or the tangible hosting of the video? You're actually selling the CD, which is the tangible video.
Yeah.
All right. That's what you're selling, right? You're not actually mm-hmm. selling the video. even on that DVD, you still don't own the rights to the video. So I give it up to this model that existed for 40 to up to 60, 70 years, right? Pay per view. Pay per view, I would pay on cable, either a monthly premium or I would pay it per movie. It will be disappear, and I will only have a certain week to watch the movie that it's available.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, essentially the shift.
Why would if that's already acceptable by society, why would society care whether it's Web 3 structure or not on a video? I can understand if you give me a CD, I should have the right to own that CD and resell it. I'm selling I'm selling you a hosting, like I'm selling you a chip with movies in it. Like it's a USB chip here. I got 10 movies here. You want it? I'll charge you $20 for it. Right. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean I own the videos in the chip.
Yeah, you don't own the rights to the intellectual property, but when you buy a DVD, that's your property.
So how is it able to be? I'm sorry, I'm being a little bit analytical.
Oh, yeah,
right?
No, it's a great
question. I just want to get it. I want to understand the structure, even for myself. I have no idea how it works. I'll be honest with you. Everyone talks to me about the Web3. I'm like, I don't know. It's not for me. But, you know, I just don't get it. Like, you're trying to apply a tangible rule of thumb or a rule of transaction to and apply it now to a intellectual property rule of transaction. An IP rule of transaction, it's always been licensure. It's never been this is all yours outright, right? Mm-hmm. Intangible transaction.